You're listening to this week's podcast by the not-so-famous sports reporters with your hosts, Austin Fine and Nicholas Charlie.
Welcome to the Not So Famous Sports Reporters Podcast. I am your host, Austin Klein, here once again alongside Nicholas Charvinen. This week is a very special podcast for us. It's our 10th, I guess by this time it's a semi-weekly podcast. It's also our Thanksgiving edition podcast. Today is November 26th. It is the day before Thanksgiving. And from us to you, we'd like to wish you a very happy Thanksgiving and a great holiday weekend.
Yeah.
All right, so on this week's show, we're going to be talking about the college football playoff system and our opinions on what we think could be done to make it better, and if it is in fact better than the old BCS system. In our NFL segment, I want to touch on the situation in Washington with the Redskins and their quarterback troubles, you know, RG3 and Cousins and everybody either injured, not playing well, or just getting in arguments with coaching staff. We'll get to that later. We'll talk about the Lions' offensive struggles, and we'll do our segment, preview a couple games this week, and what we think the outcomes of those games will be. And we will also be talking about the MLB once again this week. There's been a lot of moves this offseason that we'd like to talk about, involving the Red Sox, the Tigers.
Mets, White Sox, a lot of teams have been getting in there.
Yep, and then we're
Monty Thomas might sign soon.
And then we're going to try out a new segment. It's going to be like a segment involving our bold predictions for this week. And, you know, we'll see how that goes. So we're going to get right into it. And we hope you enjoy our 10th episode of the Not So Famous Sports Reporters Podcast. Okay, so as I said, we're going to get right to it this week with our first segment called the opening question. Our opening question this week is, it surrounds the college football playoff system, but more importantly, the undefeated team right now that is not even ranked in the top 10. So that team is Marshall. This situation greatly reminds me of the Boise State situation a couple years ago. Right now, the Marshall Thundering Herd are 11-0 and currently ranked 24th in the college football playoff rankings. So, Nick, what do you think about that? I mean, like I said, we saw the whole thing go down with Boise State. They went undefeated 2 years
in Boise,
a row. And
the thing about Boise State is that they played an even tougher schedule than Marshall, and Boise State played a fairly easy schedule. I'm looking at a schedule that looks like it has a bunch of FBS teams on it, basically. I mean, I know it's a smaller conference that they're in, but they're not playing top talent. So, I mean, I think this is one of those cases where truly, if they played a top 10 actual team, that they would get beat. Maybe not blown out, but I think they'd get beat pretty badly. Northern Illinois almost faced this situation last year, I think. They're either a one-loss team or they lost a game somewhere along the way, but they were almost a team that made it to a BCS bowl game. I think they almost did, but they didn't. But it almost looks like a Division II schedule. I mean, you know, there's tons of teams that go undefeated in Division II, and they're not going to obviously play the Division I playoffs. So I don't have a problem with them being ranked 24th, I guess. It's just kind of unlucky. Maybe if they would, in one of their non-conference games, they should schedule a power opponent. That would at least put a little more questioning into it. They would still have an easier schedule. But if they would have beaten a team at least even from a big conference, a power conference, that would make it a lot more respectable. I mean, they didn't even play anybody from like the Big Ten, even, for example, or like a weaker conference. It could even been a weaker team. It didn't have to be like Ohio State from the Big Ten. They could have played Minnesota or something, and if they beat them, it'd still look a lot better. So,
I guess for sure. The one reason I wanted to start the show off with this today is I had a discussion earlier today with a buddy of mine, and he just asked me. He said, hey, do you think Marshall should be ranked higher? And I said yes. Well, I had to clarify the question. I said, are you asking if they should be in the playoff? He said no, and I said, yeah, well, I think they could be ranked a little higher, you know. I mean, 24 is not, it's not doing, you know, I mean, they're barely squeaking in, and there's some teams that I think they could be maybe in the top 25, but I definitely agree with the strength schedule. I'm a big strength schedule guy. I've talked about, you know, the strength schedule surrounding, you know, the Michigan State, if they were going to make the college football playoff.
Yeah, but this makes Michigan, their schedule not, makes MSU's schedule look like,
well, yeah, no, I'm just proving the point that I do, in fact, I'm a big strength schedule guy, you know, because you can play, like Marshall played, I think the toughest team they played on here is what
Miami of Ohio, yeah, or Akron.
Miami of Ohio, and they beat them by 15.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the Akron Zips,
Akron's pretty bad.
Yeah.
So, they almost beat Michigan, but I remember when they were playing Michigan, that was not this year, it was last year they almost beat Michigan, but I remember they were like one of the bottom 10 teams in college football, they were saying on the Big Ten Network, Akron was. So.
They probably could beat Michigan this year.
Maybe.
Michigan. So, anyway, that's what we wanted to say about that. So, you heard it from us, we both do not think that there's a need for Marshall to be ranked any higher than they are. You know, they're ranked in the top 25 because they're undefeated. If they weren't, there'd be a huge outcry.
It's hard to go undefeated, but, you know, they're just better than their competition doesn't necessarily.
Yeah, no, they might, you know, if they, I mean, I haven't followed Marshall, but if they do any better, you know, in the next couple of years, then maybe they will get bumped up into a higher conference and play a little tougher schedule. It looks like last year they had 4 losses in the regular season. So
they played Virginia Tech last year, which is at least a better team, and they did go through overtime. So they lost that game, but that kind of, I think that's a good indicator. I mean, I don't know how much their team graduated because I obviously don't follow the Marshall Thundering Herd very closely. So I don't know how many returning starters they had or how many they're going to have next year. But the fact that they went through overtimes of Virginia Tech and still lost pretty much is a microcosm, I think, of what you could say Marshall would do against the team. And then the year before, they played number 11 West Virginia to start the year, and they got murdered. So, I mean, 2012 is kind of a bad thing to look at, though. But I think that's kind of what they do this year. They'd probably lose, but it wouldn't necessarily be a blowout, I guess. They could maybe give teams some competition. Like, when Michigan or Michigan State plays, like, Akron or whatever at the beginning of the year, when they play those easy non-conference games, maybe they should be scheduled on Marshall, because at least they're a tougher non-conference opponent that could be considered, like, you know, out of an easier conference. So,
yeah,
that would be a start for them. But, yeah, I think that's a good...
Okay, so you heard it here first, and then our second part to our opening question is I wanted to ask Nick what he thought about, you know, this year's college football playoff ranking. Is it in fact better than the BCS? I mean,
well, the BCS had computers kind of spit out the rankings. And the thing about that is people would say, well, it's all the computer. Well, no, the computer had a formula that would spit out the ranking, and part of it had to do with the AP ranking and the coaches poll. I'm pretty sure part of the BCS formula, the formula that they used. So really, there was still a human element to it. And this year, it's pretty much fully the committee. I think how it goes is they all vote, right? And then each position they vote has like a weight or something. It's weighted.
Yes.
Yeah. So I mean, I think that it's kind of silly that humans have full responsibility over picking for the 4 best teams, because there's obviously going to be a little bit of bias in this. I think I tweeted off our account when Florida State was ranked number 3 behind Bama and Oregon that I thought Florida State should at least be 1. I know Florida State's played a couple tough or closer games recently, but they still haven't lost a game in over a year and a half now, closer to 2 years. I think it's probably been over 2 years, and they deserve to be the number 1 team as long as they don't lose, I think. So I think it's a bit silly that, like Florida State is not number one. At least Florida State's still in the playoff, and it really doesn't matter because it's not like there's a home field advantage or anything. It's just you know, once you're in the playoff, you're in the playoff. So, I mean, Florida State might have a little bit of an easier opponent to play if they were ranked number one. But because yeah, I would rather play Mississippi State than Oregon, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I agree with the whole. I agree 100% with what you said about, you know, they came into the season ranked number one, and they haven't lost a game, so I don't see how they're falling yet. That just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and I just think that there should be, things go better when there's like a formula, because humans, no matter what, they're going to have a bias, especially when you're going to, even if it's just a slight bias, because you have your opinion, and your opinion is technically a bias, so a little bit. It's kind of, that's how I view it, because, you know, if you think Oregon's better than Florida State, then you're going to stick to your gut. But if every stat, there's a bunch of stats and they're showing to be really good stats, and everything's telling you Oregon's better than Florida State, then, you know, Oregon probably deserves to be higher in the ranking. I said that backwards. If everything tells you Florida State is better than Oregon, but you still think Oregon's better than Florida State, you're going to have a little bit of bias towards still picking Oregon over Florida State. So I think that they should come up with more of a formula, and maybe part of the formula can be their rankings. But I like the whole BCS formula. I just thought that maybe the BCS had too much of a human element. I like the idea of a playoff and having four teams instead of just picking two to go for the national championship, having a bit of a little tournament. I do think two things. The college playoff should be at least eight teams. I don't think one more game would hurt anybody. And I also think that the formula should be changed up a little bit to be almost closer to the BCS, to have a little bit more of a formula
behind
it.
Yeah, well, I'm confident that they'll work out the kinks, but...
I like the idea, though.
Yeah. Yeah, so I definitely think that they could do a 8-team college football playoff as well as you, Nick, because I think they could just use the four... You know, they had the four original BCS bowls, so I think that'd be a good, you know, those would be good sites for the four first round games, and then, but I guess maybe they're thinking that was they wouldn't want to hold two games in the same place, maybe, so you know, they'd have to hold two of the games in the, like, they'd have to hold two games in the Rose Bowl and two games in the Sugar Bowl.
Yeah.
So, anyways, that's our take on the college football playoff. I still definitely think it's better than last year, but what was that? Oh, I think Nick's got some breaking news for us.
Yeah, the Diamondbacks have just agreed to a deal with Yasmani Tomas, and this would be a lot cooler if you're actually a live broadcast or podcast. But that's some breaking news. We'll hit on the analysis later, but if you're somehow listening to us as your first line of MLB news, you'll be learning that Yasmani Tomas signed a 6-year deal with the Diamondbacks. He can opt out after 4 years. It's worth $68.5 million. So we'll hit on the analysis for that when we go over all the trades and signings that have happened in a few minutes here.
Okay, so moving on, I think... First, we're actually going to hit on the NFL, just stay in the realm of football.
And Thanksgiving.
Yeah, NFL, some good Thanksgiving games coming up. So, moving on. So now we're going to be talking about some recent NFL news this week. To start off our NFL segment, I'd like to talk a little bit about my favorite NFL player and his situation in Washington with the Redskins, Robert Griffin III. More commonly known as RG3. Okay, so as any fan that follows football in general knows, RG3 and the Washington Redskins have had some really bad, you know, they've performed very poorly this season. I don't know their record off the top of my head, but RG3 was injured. He played well the first game, got injured. You know, I don't know if it's that lingering knee injury. They didn't never really released quite enough information to get a reading from what they were saying, but you know, he was hurt, and he came back, and he's just not playing well. You know, I hate to say it, he's playing absolute crap. Not all his fault. He's having some trouble with the offensive line, having enough time to make throws, with the loss of, you know, a couple of their linemen earlier this season. So the line's been shuffled around, and they're just not ready to play football. It doesn't look like every week. So there's been a lot of talk about where he could end up next year. As it looks right now, RG3 probably won't be picked up by Washington next year. From what I read in this article right here, it's the option would put him in the top 15. Payment, like, salary-wise of all quarterbacks. So if he gets his option picked up, he's going to be making what a top 10 or 15 quarterback would be making. So that doesn't look like the case. Some other options would be the Eagles. Nick Foles, he wasn't playing great, but as we knew, he wasn't going to repeat his performance last year. You know, he didn't throw an interception for, like, 200 straight passes. But my top option of where he would end up is either the Jets, who have had quarterback trouble for a lot of years, from the Mark Sanchez butt fumble to, you know, the current struggles with veteran Michael Vick and Geno Smith. But the number one place for me would be the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. The Bucs might be in position to draft Jameis Winston this fall. But I wouldn't, if I were their general manager, I wouldn't take a gamble with that. I'd wait for the Redskins to let RG3 go, or just trade a low-round draft pick for him, pay him the little money that he's owed for the rest of this year, and then use their top draft pick on a lineman, because, you know, the Bucs have been building pretty good offensive line for a couple years now, and there's some good linemen in the draft that are compared to Lions tackle Riley Reiff. You know, there's a guy coming out of Iowa who basically took over after Reiff left, and he's supposed to be pretty good at the NFL level. So that's my take on RG3. Next, me and Nick are going to talk about the Lions' offensive struggles. I think we both have a little bit more to talk about there. So we're going to move on right now. Okay, so let's start talking off. Talking a little bit about the Lions. The Lions started off their season very hot. 7-2, I believe. Yeah, they started off the season 7-2. In the last 2 weeks, they faced two tough opponents, not taking anything away from them, in Arizona and New England. Both road games for the Lions, but their offense has not looked anything like it did in the first seven games. They put up a combined 15 points in those games, and they never didn't score a touchdown. It was 5 field goals. So there's definitely a problem there. What do you think about it, Nick?
Yeah, the offense has been a huge problem for the Lions. Reggie Bush has been hurt, so Bell's having to do a majority of the running, and I think that hurts Bell and hurts everybody. Theoretic's been a bright spot, but he's more of a Matt Forte type of back, where he's more of a pass catcher than an actual running back, you know. And then the wide receivers have been disappointing. Golden Tate needs to be more involved because he's their best receiver this year. Calvin's having a down year. He's been hurt. So Calvin needs to be eased back into it. And then, like, the Lions had a touchdown in the first half. Fourier would have caught a ball clean, but he bobbled it and was getting, you know, you can hit somebody once they have the ball, and he got hit and couldn't catch it after that. So, I mean, of course, because it's 10 times harder to catch it when you're getting hit than when you don't, when you, you know, you're not. So he dropped the ball, but I think as he gets healthier, he'll be a good red zone threat. So I think everything's coming together. I think the injuries are still coming together. And the good thing for the Lions is they have 3 games against bad opponents, so they can maybe ease their offense back into it. Because, really, we've seen it in every sport. It doesn't matter if you're cold the first half of the year on offense. If you get hot going into the playoffs, that's when you want to see it. I mean, this is going to a different sport, so it's a bit different. But look at the Royals, you know, they didn't have the best offense. They only hit 95 home runs this year, which, you know, home runs aren't everything on offense in baseball, but that's still a big part of it. And then the postseason, they went off hitting-wise until the World Series, and even in the World Series, they did good. So, you know, I think in any sport, it doesn't matter. This is true. It doesn't matter when you get hot, or it matters when you get hot. It just doesn't matter if you get hot going into the playoffs, it's better, I guess. That's the way to phrase it, because it doesn't matter if you're not hot during the first half, is what I was trying to say, or the first part of the year. The Royals proved that for baseball, and though football's a little bit different, you have to, you know, find another way to get there. It still has the same main point to it, I guess. So, so I think Calvin's going to get more involved. I think 4A is going to score a couple touchdowns before the year's over. And I think the Lions are going to be in good shape. One thing I'd like to see is the use of Ryan Broyles more. I feel like he'd be a good third receiver, but Caldwell's just dead set on not using him, which I don't get. And Pettigrew's probably a better option than Ebron at this point, I think, as far as... because Ebron's just... he showed that he's not a very good blocker right now, and he's not doing anything on the offensive side of the ball. So I like Pettigrew better than Ebron at this point in the year.
Yeah, I... as a pass catcher, and as far as we see so far, I'd agree with that.
Pettigrew has his fair share of drops, but he's better at this point.
Yeah, so going back to your Ryan Broyles comment, we definitely need to get somebody else involved, and we're not sure if it's going to be Broyles or if it's going to be, if like...
Fuller, maybe?
Yeah, if Fuller's going to step up in that role. But one thing I agree with is we definitely saw Tate step up greatly when
they throw the ball to him.
When they throw the ball to him, and when Kelvin Johnson was out in those, I forget how many games Johnson was out for, but starting with the game in New Orleans, Tate had 154 yards in that game, 151 in the game against Atlanta. And that was a great comeback involving Tate.
Both of them were great comebacks.
And then they beat Miami, and Johnson came back that week and had 113 yards, but I believe Tate had almost 100 as well, because Stafford had close to 300 yards passing that game. But then when Johnson came back, we lost to Arizona. We lost 14-6 in that game. That was just a hideous game. Bell did have 85 yards rushing, but that's because that's the only thing we could get going that game. Johnson only had 59 yards receiving, and he was our receiving leader that game.
Because they targeted him like six times as much as Tate.
Yeah, they targeted him 15 times in that game. I believe he had seven catches.
And Tate only got targeted twice, so that's over.
Yeah, he didn't. That's
eight times as much.
Yeah, so anyways, that game, especially when we went fourth down to try to keep our last drive going, there was a pass to Kelvin Johnson, and Tate was running. Tate just ran, you know, like a five yard. It was like a fourth and three, and Tate ran like a 5 yard curl route, and Kelvin Johnson just, or I mean, Matt Stafford just looked over him. He had he had tunnel vision, Kelvin Johnson, as I've heard some people say. And then last week versus New England, I just believe even if our offense was going well that game, I don't think we would have scored 34 points.
What do you think of Raiola? He did.
You know, that's... I mean, it's not exactly classy, but, you know, he did it. He's going to get fined for it, not suspended. I mean, the Detroit football's kind of got a reputation with Sue, and now Raiola just came up straight out and admitted that. You know, I definitely would... If I was in Raiola's shoes, I definitely wouldn't come straight out and admit it. I would have maybe...
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too, because I'm more of a baseball fan, obviously, but when pitchers throw at somebody, because that happens still, it still happens, pitchers will intentionally throw at hitters if they piss them off or something, makes them mad, it happens, you know, if you follow baseball, you know the unwritten rules, but after the game, the reporters will ask him, well, you know, you hit, you know, if, just let's just say, Jared Weaver hit Alex Avila, even though that was blatant, it happened in 2011. If somebody asked him, he didn't hit Avila, he threw it at his head. You know, if somebody asked Weaver, though, and it wasn't obvious, I doubt Weaver would have answered, oh yeah, I was trying to hit him. You don't hear pitchers say that in baseball, and I think it's the same idea. If you're going to do a dirty play, at least don't admit it, because it just makes it look 10 times worse. I just think that was stupid on Rayola's part, too.
Yeah, but I mean, definitely don't admit it. I mean, it may or may not have came out if he did, because he admitted it like right after the game that day, which, like we just said, we're reiterating that it's very silly to admit it. But it probably would have came out anyways. If Rayola didn't admit it, then whoever he laid the walk down on probably would have said, you know, they took a cheap shot at me. Or anyways, back to our main point of this little segment. The Lions' offensive struggles. You know, their defense is still playing great. They allowed 34 points at New England, but you know, Tom Brady is a different breed. And besides Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, he's a great coach, and I actually think he calls most of the plays in New England. So anyway, but while we're talking about play calling, Joe Lombardi, I was very excited about him coming into the year, and I was pretty excited, you know, up until now, really, because his last two games, he hasn't been able to get us into the end zone. And I know Caldwell kind of took some of the heat for that. I read an article, and it had an interview in it. Caldwell said, you know, Lombardi, he gives the plays to me, and, like, he basically said, every play goes through me. Lombardi relays the plays through me through, you know, their headset communication. And if Caldwell likes the play, he goes with it. And if he doesn't like it, he changes it. But, I mean, I don't think he's changed as many plays because there wasn't not much time for that.
Part of it's got to be on the players, too. Like, you can't just fire a coach every time.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
The coordinator to blame because...
Oh, for sure.
Because, like, Fourier should have caught that pass in the first quarter. I think it was definitely the first half of the game.
It was the beginning of the second quarter. He could have caught the pass. There was a little shove on him. But, I mean, you talk about easing Kelvin Johnson back. Fourier's been hurt, too. He had his ankle's been hurt, so...
Yeah.
I mean, that didn't have anything to do with catching a pass, but maybe he just wasn't able to, you know, push off the ground to get himself into a position to make the catch.
Yeah.
Anyways, I think the keys to this are definitely just, they're going to have to find someone in practice that gets, you know, that'll help them, that's going to step up and help them in the receiving game. And I think the other key to this is that they're going to have to get the running game going. I know I mentioned in Arizona, Bell was our leading rusher with 85 yards, but that's the most yards our running backs had all year. And I think just a rough estimate, I think the Lions have only had two or three games where they've even reached 100 yards rushing, like, all together between their backs. So I'd like to see when Bush comes back, definitely get him involved, but... And Bush is more of a dual threat also, but...
He's still decent at running.
Yeah, the big guy I'd like to see is George Wynn. I'd like to see them give him another shot at it. He was a big part. He was a big part in a game earlier this season. They gave me against Buffalo. He was a huge part. played a huge part in that game. And I think he could be a back complementary to Bell before Bush comes back. Because Bell's always been more of a third down back. You know, he toughs it out. So, those are a couple keys to the Lions' success. I think I had one more thing I wanted to talk about. Oh, yes. I'm going to go to the NFL games for this week. And we're just going to pick a few of them to preview. So, get to that in a minute. Okay, so the first game of the week is the Lions and the Bears. They play, it's one of the marquee Thanksgiving matchups, and of course the Lions are hosting this one at Ford Field in Detroit. And I think the Lions are going to get back at their winning ways and defeat the Bears this week. The Bears haven't been that good this season. The Lions should be, you know, ready and hungry to get back out there and get back in the win column.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be a blowout because it is pretty tough to play on a 3-day layoff. That's it. But I think the Lions are going to win this game and build a Thanksgiving winning streak after losing like 10 in a row, I think, or close to that. They might win 2 in a row finally on Thanksgiving. I like them against the Bears this year. But if I had to give you a score, I'd say 27-24 Detroit Lions, because the Bears are still a decent team and it's going to be close. And I just think that playing on 3 days rest is really a disadvantage. Now, yeah, it's a disadvantage to both sides, but I think it'll make the game closer than it could have been. But the Lions really have 3 easy home games coming up, and then a winnable road game in Chicago. So they really need to at least win 3 of the next 4 just to, stay in the playoff hunt. And maybe they'll get lucky and get the 5 seed and get to play the Falcons or Saints or whoever may win that division in the first round if they win these next 4 games. Because then the game against the Packers at Lambeau isn't as important to them. So I think they're going to build on that, and I think Caldwell's going to have them ready to go tomorrow. And I think the defense will play well. The only reason that I have Chicago scoring so high is because the rest factor, really.
Yeah, I'd say the number one key to this game for the Lions is they're going to have to stop the passing attack. Matt Forte, yes, he can run the ball, but as you said earlier, comparing him to Theo Riddick, he's more of a receiving back, and, as we know, the Lions aren't known for their defensive backs being all that great, although they have performed well this season. Having Forte in the backfield definitely gives Chicago an edge in the passing game.
Yeah, it's their first meeting this year, but the Lions swept the Bears last year, and, they're fairly, the same teams that they were, There's always some additions and subtractions, but I just like the Lions in this. I think they're going to win it.
All right, so the second Thanksgiving game we got for you is the Eagles and the Cowboys. They play at 4:30.
Yep, and they're in Dallas because the Cowboys always host a game, too. That one is going to be close, too. I'm going to go with the Cowboys, though, as much as it pains me, because they're one game ahead of the Lions in the wild card race. They're the 5th seed right now, and the Lions are the 6th seed, technically, by strength of schedule. But I think Dallas is going to win in a close one. They always seem to do that on Thanksgiving. And I think the Eagles are going to play good, and I'm going to give that one a 27-24 final. I think it's going to be close. I think Tony Romo leads the Cowboys to a game-winning drive down 21-20 in the fourth quarter. I like the home field advantage for the Cowboys here.
See, I'm going to disagree with you on that one. I'm going to go with the Philadelphia Eagles to defeat the Cowboys in Dallas on Thanksgiving. I think Sanchez is going to have a good game tomorrow. Receiver I'm going to pick to have a big part against the Cowboys pass defense is Jordan Matthews. He's had a couple good games. One, he caught 2 touchdowns in Mark Sanchez's debut as a Philadelphia Eagle. And I think he's going to catch a touchdown or 2 tomorrow against the Cowboys, propelling the Eagles to a win on Thanksgiving. So, and then the
last one
we have the Thursday night football game. Yeah. It's extra special, Thursday night football and on Thanksgiving. That's going to be a good one. We got the Seahawks and the 49ers. The Seahawks are traveling to San Francisco on Thursday night football. So
I've liked the 49ers over the years, and I think they're really a good team. But I'm going to take the Seahawks here. They're building momentum. They're starting to play better as a team after losing all their wide receivers and Golden Tate talking some smack. They're starting to get back into the groove. I like Russell Wilson finding his groove here. I like Sherman rebounding against Michael Crabtree, or whatever matchup he may face. And I like the Seahawks in this one. I think they're going to win by at least a touchdown, even in the road. So I think the Seahawks are going to push for a playoff spot. But all these games are involving NFC teams. I just realized that. And they're all of them have wild card importance to them, because those are the 5, 6, and 7 teams playing, and then the Eagles and 40, and the 5, 6, 7, and 8 right teams, and the Eagles are leading their division. So there's five teams that are really still in it that are playing important games tomorrow, so that'll be really interesting to watch.
Yeah, so a good Thanksgiving for us football guys, as the wives and girlfriends are out doing their early Black Friday shopping. Which is absolutely ridiculous. It's Black Friday, and they start at Thursday at like 5 o'clock now. So right after dinner, they'll be out of the house. Could watch some football. So, should be a good Thanksgiving for everybody there. Sunday, to lead off the game Sunday, the Browns travel to Buffalo, who will in fact be at home this week after they had to play in Detroit last week due to their massive snowfall. So the Browns and the Bills, what do you think?
Geez, it's a good game. It's going to be a close one, but I'm going to go with the Bills at home. I just don't think the Browns are overperforming. I think Hoyer is definitely proven that he should be the starting quarterback for right now. But I just like the Bills because they're home here.
Do you think it's going to be a close game?
Yeah, it'll be closer. I can't really give you an amount total, but it'll be within single digits, maybe, I guess.
Okay, so I'm gonna go with the Browns also on this one. Back at home this week, excited to be playing in their own stadium in front of their fans.
You're going with the Browns or the Bills?
The Bills.
Okay, I think you said the Browns by accident.
Well, if I said the Browns, I meant the Bills. Going with the Bills this week, I say the Bills win by 10. Kyle Orton's going to lead a nice game, I believe. I think Sammy Watkins is going to play a big part. So Bills by 10. Like I said, happy to be back in their own stadium in front of their own fans. So moving on, we have the Chargers at the Ravens.
That's another good one, too. I'm going to take the Ravens. I think the Chargers are falling out of it. Phillip Rivers is not performing the way he performed. And the Ravens are starting to step up, and I think they're proving their playoff team, and I think they'll prove it even more in that game at home.
Yeah, I agree with you here. I think the Ravens are going to win this one at home. They're definitely pushing towards a playoff spot right now. It's a matchup of 2-7-4 teams, which is just nice. The Ravens are going to take this one. I see Forsett stepping up in the run game, maybe scoring a touchdown against a not-so-strong Chargers defense, and maybe having a few long runs as well, which we haven't seen much of from him. So both of us picked the Ravens on that one. And the next game we're going to go for is the Panthers and the Vikings. Two not-so-good teams, which is surprising because the Lions lost to the Panthers earlier this year, and we definitely thought the Panthers were going to be better than 3-7-1 team.
Yeah, this is a tough one.
They're playing in Minnesota.
This one's going to be a snooze fest. I'm going to take the Panthers, just edging out the Vikings. Just barely. I don't know, it's just going to be close, but it seems like it's one of those games that could end up being like 12-9 or something with all field goals. It just doesn't seem like it'll be a great game. Cam Newton really has to step up, though. He may be 3-7-1, but he's only half game out of the playoffs, so they got to win this. It's a must-win for Carolina, and I think they're going to pull through. All
right, well, I'm going to go for the Vikings on this one. You know, I think the Vikings are obviously not going to be a playoff team or even, close to the top of their division, but I think they're just going to pull. I think they're going to pull one out here. I think Bridgewater's been playing well. And he might be the quarterback they've been looking for a while. So, Vikings over the Panthers in this one. And now we have the Titans and the Texans. Another matchup of two not-so-good teams. The Texans have had quarterback trouble all season, and so have the Titans. The Titans are worse than the Texans, but not by much.
They're on Zach Mettenberger. Yeah, I'm going to go with the Texans here. They must have pushed all the good games up to Thursday. I'm going to go the Texans here by 10, though.
Okay. Yeah, I'm also going to take the Texans. Ryan Mallett was placed on injured reserve. He's been the quarterback for the Texans for most of the season. But Ryan Fitzpatrick is going to get the start in Houston this week. He hasn't had a start in quite a while.
He played his former team, I remember that. He played him when they played the Bills because he got his team pumped up. I don't know if any of you saw the video, but he started saying a bunch of stuff, and it just sounded gibberish. But Fitzpatrick is an Ivy League Ivy League guy, so maybe you'll be able to outsmart the Titans. But it shouldn't be that hard of a battle or a game for Fitzpatrick. He was a decent quarterback too.
And yeah, I give him that over the you know, I think the Texans were starting to get comfortable with Mallett in there. He was 2-1 as a starter, but he had a torn pectoral muscle, so that ended his season quickly, which is a shame because I was really excited getting to see him play because he was stuck behind Brady in New England for a couple years. So, but yeah, like I said, I'm gonna go with the Texans on this one. Fitzpatrick, he's a decent quarterback. He's been in the league for a few years, and I think he's gonna get his timing down with, you know, Andre Johnson, DeAndre Hopkins, and them. So should be a decent game, but I just don't think the Titans are ready to, you know, win against a good defense like the Texans yet. So the Giants and the Jaguars, another bad game we got here.
I'll take the Giants. They blew a game against Dallas last week, but the Jaguars are still the Jaguars. They're not the worst team in their league anymore. That belongs to the Raiders, but they're pretty much the second worst in my opinion. And I think the Giants are a little bit more talented than their record. I think the more interesting thing is the over-under on how many amazing catches Odell Beckham will have in that game. So yeah, I'll take the Giants by a lot.
Yeah, I think the Jaguars they're obviously not there yet. They got Denard Robinson working in the backfield, and
he had 2 good weeks, but he's kind of slowed down.
And I think that's all. I think that's about all they have going for him because their rookie quarterback Blake Bortles, who I was excited about, has the second lowest. I saw this on SportsCenter earlier today. He has the second lowest quarterback rating out of quarterbacks with at least 150 pass attempts this year.
Who has the worst?
It was somebody who only played a few games.
Oh, so he's pretty much the worst starting quarterback, is what you're saying?
Definitely the worst starting quarterback, according to the total QBR stat.
It's a decent stat.
And Raiders versus Rams is our next game. The 1-10 Raiders travel to St. Louis to take on Sean Hill and the 4-7 St. Louis Rams.
Well, something weird's going to happen in this game. The sports are weird. The Raiders just won their first game, and the Rams beat the Broncos with Sean Hill just a week or two ago. But I just see the Raiders somehow coming in and winning this game. I think Carr's going to have a confidence boost, and they're going to put together a 2-game winning streak, the Raiders. They're going to beat the Rams. It's not like this is a, you know, real tough game for the Raiders. It's still not the greatest opponent. So I think the Raiders are going to come in somehow, squeak out a win.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go with the Rams in this one. They're a better team, first of all. I like the emergence of Trey Mason's in last week's game. I believe he had he had 100 yards last game. I'm rooting for Sean Hill, as I mentioned. That, and I think it was our first or second podcast that I was rooting for Sean Hill once we saw their starter go down. So, finally a decent game. We got the Patriots and the Packers.
Yeah, the Patriots took care of the Lions last week fairly easily. Packers are in the same division. The Packers have a slightly better record. That's a tough game.
It's in Lambeau.
It's at Lambeau. I'm going to take the Packers then. Their offense has just been just on fire. So the Patriots, I don't know. I just don't think they're going to be able to stop the Packers. I think the Packers are going to win.
Yeah, they're a nice stat for you. The Packers are outscoring their opponents by at least, it's like 100 points. They're outscoring their opponents by 100 points in the first half at Lambeau.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think they're going to beat the Patriots.
I don't think they're going to get out as quick a start as they had their last couple games. They were up on the Bears, 35-0 at halftime.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think they're going to quite do that again. Aaron Rodgers is a good quarterback.
You can't do that every game, though, wherever we are.
But I do think the Packers are going to win at Lambeau this week. Eddie Lacy's been back for a few, 4 or 5 weeks now after he got rid of his concussion symptoms. He's playing well. He's had a couple big runs. He can catch the ball, so you know that the Packers are just an all-around good team.
Yeah, they're a good team.
Okay, so this NFL segment's running a little long. We got to hurry up and finish it up. But just a quick little thing I saw when in Bill Belichick's press conference today, he was asked to compare Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers, and he didn't say anything. But the statement he said, "Well, they both wear number 12." So, great comparison there, Belichick. But
well, that's a classic Bill Belichick press conference.
But moving on, we have two more games. We have the Broncos and the Chiefs, and in Kansas City.
Broncos, the Chiefs just—they don't have that next level of team. They win the games they're supposed to win, and I know they took it to the Patriots earlier this year, and that's the one everybody turns to. Oops. To show that they were, you know, a good team, but the Broncos are just better. So I'm going to go with the Broncos.
Yeah, I think the Broncos are going to bounce back from their loss last week. I think they have to bounce back from their loss last week, in fact.
The Chiefs kind of remind me of the Lions. They win all the games they're supposed to, and then every once in a while, they'll beat a team with a winning record. But most of the time, they're losing to really good play teams in the playoffs, and they lost in the playoffs to the Colts, so I don't know.
Alright, so it's the last game of the week. It's the Monday Night Football game. And it's the Dolphins versus the Jets in New Jersey.
Whoever picked out the Monday Night Football games really needs to be fired. You need to get someone else picking out those games. The Dolphins.
I don't think there's much to say about that game.
If you watched any of the highlights of the Bills taking it to the Jets, multiply that by like 1.1 because the Dolphins are slightly better than the Bills, I think, and there you got your result.
Which I wish I could have been there, but
The ticket system didn't work, but that's another story for another day.
Huge shout out to the Lions.
Ticket the up. Organizers well, for that. Their website crashing.
Anyways, the Dolphins, they're just gonna take it to the Jets. The Jets can't figure it out. They have two quarterbacks basically right now, both of which are not good at all, not NFL-level quarterbacks. Well, they are NFL-level quarterbacks, but
they were at one point.
They're not playing like it. So, but in other news, the Jets have decided to start Geno Smith again this week, so we'll see how that goes.
They might just turn to their third stringer eventually.
Who is their third stringer?
I have no clue, but it can't be much worse of an option.
I'm not even sure they have a third quarterback.
Oh, jeez.
Okay, so moving on, we're going to move on to talking about the MLB, moves that have happened in the past week or two involving some Red Sox moves, some Tigers moves, trade rumors, Diamondbacks, White Sox.
Yeah, there's a lot of different
Mets.
A lot of them we'll be hitting on really quick, but
yep, so we're just going to take a few minutes to talk about that, and moving on right now.
The Tigers made the second splash of the offseason, because the first one was Kadir, by re-signing DH Victor Martinez. I thought that was a great deal for the Tigers. They need him in the middle of the lineup. He's going to be 39 when the contract's over, but they want to win. And if they win the World Series or two, no question the contract is good. They need him in the lineup. He seems like, to me, one of those guys who's going to age well and hit well into his older years. So I think that was a great move for the Tigers. And I'm not really concerned about the future, because you can't really predict the future in baseball. I mean, how many people had the Giants and Royals going to the World Series this year? Nobody really did, and that was just right before the year, so I don't see how anybody could say, well, the Tigers are going to stink in 2019 because they got all these big contracts. Dabrowski traded Fielder's contract. I mean, you know, there's definitely they have a good general manager in charge, and if the contracts get bad, he might be able to flip them for something, but I'm not too worried about 2018 right now. I'm worried about winning this year as a Tiger fan this upcoming year, and I think Victor Martinez gives us the best chance to do so. The Tigers also made a move later that night by acquiring Anthony Gost. They still need a corner outfielder, most likely, even though Dombrowski said he sat at outfield and sat at relief, in relief pitching. He said that recently. I think that's just all hearsay. But Anthony Gost was acquired for the Tigers' number one prospect, and I say that the way I do because
he was not probably their number one prospect. Derek Hill and Kevin Zomek were both better than him, in my opinion, and probably arguably Stephen Moya. He was probably more like their fourth best prospect. But they traded Devon Travis, who nonetheless has a good future, and he seems like a good guy, and he's a good hitter and everything. But he got traded to Toronto for Anthony Gosse, and I've heard a lot of whining about that from Tiger fans. But I like the deal, especially if they sign a corner outfielder. You got a Gosse and Davis platoon in center, and Gosse is 10 times the fielder Rajai Davis is. He's a great fielder and a fast guy at the very, very least. So he's already an upgrade over like Zeke Carrera or Quinton Berry in the past few years because he's a great fielder. And he was a top 40 prospect, but 2 years ago, he's only 24. You know, he's still got room to hit or mature hitting wise, but he's never going to be like a power hitter. He'll always be more of a small ball type hitter, but he can definitely improve his hitting. And I really like the trade for the Tigers. He's under team control for a long time still, and I think Gosse is going to help the Tigers out. I think Travis was a fair price to pay.
So if he's 10 times the fielder of Rajai Davis, how many times would that make him the fielder of Zeke Carrera?
Well, 10 times in more of a figurative way. I don't really know. I'd have to look at the numbers, but he's probably at least 3 times as better as Zeke Carrera if you look at numbers, I would say.
Yeah, and I definitely agree with you that I like that trade. At first, I thought maybe not, but as I've looked at the stats and looked at the facts about it, I definitely like the trade. Gives the Tigers a good defender in center, and at the very least, another guy who can steal some bases for him.
And a young guy, yeah, because Davis is getting up there. Okay, so those are the Tigers' moves. Overall, I like the Tigers' moves so far. I think they need to keep making moves. There's so many options. We've heard Yoenis Cespedes for Porcello, rumors re-signing Max. We'll get more into that in the next show. They'll probably make a move by the time we do next show. But we're running shorter on time today for MLB because Thanksgiving weekend football takes charge. So we'll talk about the Tigers more next show. But so far, I like their offseason. But we're just going to talk about the stuff that has happened today. There's a lot of rumors with Porcello and Price, and I wouldn't be surprised if Dombrowski made a blockbuster-esque trade, maybe not a full-out blockbuster, but trading a good guy for a good guy wouldn't surprise me. So moving on, some of the free agent signings. Michael Kodire signed 2 years with the Mets, and the laughing matter of the day, in his press conference quote, he said he wanted to play somewhere where he could win the next 2 years, which I don't think the move makes sense on either end. You're taking Kodire out of Colorado and putting him into New York. And I think, you know, I don't think he'll be a total utter failure. He's not going to hit, like, below the Mendoza line for the Mets. But I don't think he's going to be nearly as good as he was in Colorado. And for the Mets, it doesn't make sense because they're probably still at least another year away from contending. They need at least another year, in my opinion. And Kodire's older, and after this two-year deal, he might retire, so... and they lose a draft pick, a potential building block. They lose their first-round draft pick because Kodire rejected his qualifying offer from the Rockies. So it was a baffling move from that standpoint. I'm not sure I liked it. A move I did like, though, the White Sox signed Adam LaRoche, the first baseman. Him and Abreu could split time. Abreu's not the greatest fielder. The only thing that's going to suck for Abreu is that pretty much takes him out of the running for any MVP awards because no DH has really ever... No full-time DH has won the MVP in recent memory for me. You know, I view the DH as having a zero war defensively. It's better than having a negative war, which is the situation they face with Abreu because he was a little bit below average. But, you know, some people think you need the field, even though I think the DH is a justified position. I have a little bit of a different opinion. But that's the impact it has on Abreu. I don't think it'll have any impact on his offensive numbers. It's just more of his award-type numbers. But LaRoche is a good first baseman. He gets on base a lot. He's going to hit a lot of homers in Chicago. He didn't have the best average last year, but his on-base percentage was really good. His on-base percentage was almost 100 points higher than his average. So I'm not sure he can quite keep that pace, but I still think it was a good two-year signing for them nonetheless. The White Sox, they have a team that could surprise people. The AL Central is really looking like one of the better divisions in baseball. The White Sox could sneak into everything this year, and the Royals... Even though I think the Royals are bound to regress a little bit this upcoming year, they're still going to be a good team. And the Indians, I think, are only getting better. And the Tigers are still obviously good. So I think there could be four really good teams. The Twins
are pretty much a joke right now. They don't have any pitching, so. But I like that move as far as making the White Sox better. Today, Yasmani Tomas signed with the Diamondbacks in a very affordable deal. It seems like Tomas is going to come right to the majors, and I think it's a great deal. It's only like a $12 million average annual value for Tomas, and there's an opt-out after 4 years. Chase Field isn't the best place to hit in the world, but I think it's an okay fit. Not a lot of pressure for him, and I really like the deal for Arizona. They did not have Goldschmidt, Trumbo, and Tomas in the middle of that lineup. And I think that move just makes the Diamondbacks a lot better. I think the Diamondbacks could really improve a lot based upon their last season. I think they could be one of the teams that has one of the biggest win gains if they had maybe a pitcher or two. So I like that move for the Diamondbacks. It only makes them better. And Tomas is going to have 30 homer potential. Don't expect a crazy great average or anything this year. But, it's always hard to tell coming over from Cuba. But him and Castillo, Rizdy Castillo, should both have pretty good first seasons in the MLB, I think. And then a big trade happened. Of course, we covered it last podcast. The tragic death of Oscar Tavares happened in the DR, Dominican Republic. And that, not only is that a sad thing and everything along those lines, because, of course, that's most important, but the Cardinals obviously kind of had to replace him. And they did that by getting Jason Hayward, because Tavares was the right fielder of the future, and now they didn't really have one, so they had to get a right fielder. So they gave up Shelby Miller and Tyrell Jenkins for 1 year, at least, to Jason Hayward, even though I think they might be able to get him to sign an extension. I like that deal for the Cardinals. Shelby Miller is an okay pitcher. I don't think he's ever going to be an ace, but the Braves' pitching staff looks pretty good. The Braves were going for Tomas, but they missed out on him now, obviously. So that kind of hurts him. But Justin Upton can move back to right, and Gaz can play left unless they make another move. So it was a move that I guess the Braves could make, but Hayward was not only a fan favorite, but he was great defensively and had a really big value to the Braves. So that loss is still going to be pretty big for the Braves. But at least they didn't get nothing back. Shelby Miller is an okay return. Tyrell Jenkins, he has a chance to become pretty good in the next few years. And then the Cardinals also got Jordan Walden, which is kind of forgotten in that deal, but he could be a decent part of their bullpen this year. He's a decent arm, and he's been traded twice now, but once he got traded for Tommy Hansen before Tommy Hansen fell off the face of the earth, and then once he now got traded with Jason Hayward for two good pitchers, so I think Jordan Walden's a pretty valuable reliever to have around. And the Cardinals, I think, have at least 2 years of him. So I like that move for St. Louis.
I was surprised by the Tomas' decision, because I was definitely, I read the MLB trade rumors reported that the front runners were the Padres and the Braves for Tomas, and of course we were hoping that the Tigers would be able to get him at a fair price, but it didn't look like the Tigers were ever.
The good thing is the Tigers have pretty fairly big corner outfield market where they can grab a good corner outfielder for. So in that aspect for the Tigers, it's not the biggest loss in the world. They saved a little bit of money, but Tomas would have been good, of course. So the last thing we're going to talk about as far as MLB moves is the Red Sox made a big splash. They signed Hanley Ramirez to a 4-year deal worth $88 million and Pablo Sandoval for 5 years near $100 million. I like the Hanley deal as long as he stays healthy. What I don't like is the fact that right now they're keeping Bogaerts. Obviously, they have just a ton of position players, and they're going to trade some of that for pitching, and they're going to go after Lester, too. The Red Sox could end up building a super team, but they did that in 2011, and it didn't get them anywhere, so I don't think it automatically makes them the best team in the AL. But Pablo is going to get better in Boston, and I still think that was going to be a bad deal, because he's vastly overrated, I think. On the offensive side of baseball, he only averages about a .280 batting average and 14 homers, and not even a 3-win WAR over the past few years. And there was a guy at Baseball Prospectus last year who did some math, and of players that signed free agent contracts that weren't under team control or rookies, and the average cost of a win in the MLB is like 5 million. I think it's a little bit higher than that, but it was somewhere in there. And
So, you know, to get really good value, you'd have to be under that. And then to get normal value, you'd have to be right around that. But for Pablo, they're playing a lot more than that. So he really needs to step up. Playing at Fenway can only really help him as far as power. But I still think that Pablo deal is going to be bad. He's got to watch his weight. He's a decent fielder right now. He's an okay fielder. But as he grows older, I just don't think his fielding ability will be there. And the Red Sox fielding is just not going to look pretty with Hanley in left. But I like the Hanley signing overall, if they can get him to shortstop and maybe trade Bogaerts. But I think Bogaerts could contend with Pablo being as good as Pablo in a few years. So I think they would have been better off just signing Hanley, sticking him at shorter third, and keeping Bogaerts at shorter third. They could have made up their mind. But they went for Pablo, and now they can probably get a good pitcher for Bogaerts. So, you know, they're going to have a good team, and they're probably going to have a winning record next year. But I don't think that guarantees them anything. And they definitely need to worry about getting pitching now, because that's a big concern. And their lineup has a few concerns, too. The Red Sox aren't the perfect team because of this. They're still going to have a rookie catcher, which a good rookie catcher at that, but you never know how that'll turn out. Obviously, their starting pitching is a question mark. Is Napoli going to be able to keep up the production? Because Napoli's getting pretty old. Poppy's going to be 40 pretty soon. I mean, he's due to have at least a little bit of a drop-off pretty soon, even though he's still pretty valuable. And then, you know, the defense, the outfield situation, or like what outfielders are smart to keep. The Red Sox have some important decisions to make coming up. And I don't like the signing of Sandoval, even though I think he'll do decent, at least his first few years in Boston, same with Hanley. It's hard to predict more than 3 or 4 years down the road. You know, the Red Sox, those deals were okay in some aspects. But I just don't think the Sandoval contract's going to end up living up to its value. Quite that much. So the Red Sox moves are, you know, there's a good side and a bad side to them, I guess. Because they got two good players, even though I think Sandoval is, you know, overrated. He's still a decent player. This is a point I want to make. A lot of people, when I say overrated, they just assume I'm saying Sandoval's bad or something. Sandoval is not a bad player. You can be good and overrated. It's very possible. So when I'm talking about Sandoval in that sense, that's the way I'm talking about him, I think. So, I like that deal for the Red Sox. And quick thing before we leave the segment, if there's any Giants fans out there, you're probably devastated because he was a fan favorite. But if you guys go Chase Headley, that'd be smart. Headley's pretty good, and I think his contract will be worth it, and I think he could bring some big offensive production to San Francisco. His market's going to heat up now. So we'll get more into baseball next week. I'm sure there'll be other things that happen. We'll talk a little bit about rumors and stuff some more next week, more than we got into it this week. So we're going to head on to our next thing.
If you'd like to interact with Nick and I on social media, you can follow and tweet our podcast account on Twitter at NSF Sports Report, or you can email us, and we'll give you a shout-out on our show. The email is nsfsportsreporters@gmail.com. And you can go to our website at nsfsportsreporters.wordpress.com. We're trying to find time to get some more interesting articles up on there for you guys. So just be patient with us. But if you tweet us or email us, we'll definitely get back to you right away. If you have any questions that you want to ask us, or if you just want a shout out on the podcast, that's fine too. We'd love to do that for you. I know we got some very loyal listeners out there, so
one or two of you.
Yeah, maybe three or four, including our parents, you know. So do that. So once again, get us on Twitter at NSF Sports Report. Email notsofamoussportsreporters@gmail.com. Unfortunately, due to time constraints on this week's episode of this podcast, we will not be able to get to the previously scheduled Take It to the Bank segment. So if you're looking forward to that, I'm sorry. We'll try to get it into our episode next week. But we'd like to thank you for listening to our podcast once again. And we'd like to wish you a safe and happy holiday weekend. We're gonna celebrate, oh yeah, alright, don't stop the dancing.